Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Now it's time for the Brain Injury Radio with your host, Craig Cecilia.
Hey, everyone. Hey, everyone. This is Ashok Rajamani from New York City, your host for tonight. And I'm coming as your host after some time away. I'd like to say that tonight's show is sponsored by Lehman Law Firm. But I'm not the only one returning after some time away. My dear brain injury brothers and sisters, I'm very, very delighted to also announce the return of our nation's preeminent brain injury expert and icon, Dr. Gregory Oshanek, the one and only chairman of board of directors and medical director emeritus of the Brain Injury Association of America. Over the past 30 years, he has treated more than 11,000 patients with brain injuries while serving on the faculties of three different medical schools. He holds board certification in four medical subspecialties: behavioral neurology, neuropsychiatry, neurorehabilitation, psychosomatic medicine, and general psychiatry, and has published three books, 12 academic textbook chapters, and more than 70 peer-reviewed publications. And he has presented at national and international medical conferences and has served as an advisor to numerous federal agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Department of Defense, and National Institutes of Health, and National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. Dr. Oshanek, words can't say how delighted I am to have you back on my show on Craig Cecilia's Brain Injury Radio Network.
Well, Ashok, thank you very much for that quite generous introduction, and I appreciate the comments. Hopefully I will live up to everything that you kind of have set up for me. I'll do my best.
Great. We are so happy to have you here. And now, as some of you might remember, I'm an 11-year survivor of an extreme massive brain hemorrhage stroke and had major brain surgery at the age of 25. The near-fatal hemorrhage was brought on by an arteriovenous malformation, or an AVM. This is a very rare birth defect of a tangle of arteries and veins within the brain. Not many people know they have brain AVMs until they explode, and when they do, they usually die. My hemorrhage left me in a hospital where I had many scares, including internal blood rot, septic hematomas, and tubes drilled violently in my skull to drain fluid and blood, and two bouts of meningitis and much more before my skull was drilled open to scoop out the part of my brain where the AVM was, and my arteries then were stapled my skull plate was secured back by titanium. Now, I had little chance to live, yet I survived, but I became a baby, learning how to walk, speak, eat, go to the bathroom, and after 4 years of painful recovery, I wrote a memoir about my experience. And I'm pleased to say Algonquin Books will be publishing this memoir to bookstores worldwide in spring 2012. So besides being a survivor of severe brain trauma, I'm also an author, and you can find info about me on my site, ashokrajamani.com. That's ashokrajamani.com. So now let me discuss my show tonight. It's called Why So Sensitive? Well, although you may think it's about emotional sensitivity, this is going to be about physical sensitivity, the type that happens to the senses after brain injury, and seeing and smelling and hearing and touching and tasting. And now, as I always do, let me give you the reason why I chose this topic. Well, my brain hemorrhage has left me definitely oversensitive emotionally. But it's added physical sensitivities as well, especially to my sight, smell, and hearing. This is what I want to discuss tonight. The most important sense that has been affected is probably my sight, which has now become permanently half-blind in both eyes. This type of blindness, this type of bisected blindness, is called hemianopsia. It's a usual result of strokes and hemorrhages, especially if the vision lobe has been affected, like mine was. The massive brain hemorrhage exploded it. and it was in the right occipital lobe, which is now why I'm blind in the left half in both eyes. This is an awful sort of blindness, as I see no black line that would indicate the end of my vision. I have to turn my head around all the time like an oscillating fan. Not quite as bad as Linda Blair in The Exorcist, but sometimes the head spinning feels just like that. In public, on occasion, I've walked into the women's bathroom, since with my blindness, all I see is the word men, and I've been hit by quite a few walls and objects and doors, not to mention being bloodied by street poles that I do not see and run into. What's worse is when I accidentally smash into people, especially in the New York City streets where people don't take kindly to these things. So I've gotten yelled at, threatened physically, and all that stuff. Of course, when I say I'm half blind, nobody believes me, as I look completely fine, completely sighted. People think I should carry a cane or wear sunglasses. They say it in jest, but sometimes I do wish there was a way for others to see that I do have a form of blindness. Anyhow, because of this type of blindness, my good friend Rebecca Terrell is at my side and handles the switchboard. So this hemianopsia, this bisected blindness, that's what's been irritating me lately. That's why I want to do this show. Another thing that bugs me about my senses is something that most of you can probably relate to, or at least some of you. It's called tinnitus. This is a constant whooshing or squealing within your ears. In my book, I call it chasing ambulances in my head. Now, this is a constant irritation, which makes it hard when you're trying to read a book or trying to sleep in quiet. Compensation methods include putting on a white noise radio or leave the stereo on. I just leave my TV on at night. I was told my case of extreme tinnitus was caused by both my hemorrhage and two bouts of meningitis that I suffered. Another sense thing I face is because of another deficit I have been left with. That's epilepsy, or seizure disorder. Now, here's the deal for you non-epilepsy people. Right before a seizure, there's a situation called an aura, where we people with epilepsy face it. Here's where the senses come in. It's a smell of burning rubber, meeting decaying, rotting metal. I haven't had a seizure in many years, but the idea of this smell still terrifies me. So when I walk past a restaurant with pungent odors or, as New York has, you know, dirty streets when I walk by them, I freak out. I'm thinking an aura is happening. Of course, my compensation is simply not to be around those places, but it still doesn't stop me from getting nervous about the stench of burning rubber. What saddens me is that I've heard all sorts of horror stories from other brain hemorrhage stroke survivors. One young man's hearing was so affected, he had such sensitivity to his hearing, he couldn't bear to hear the sound of his own two little sons. His sons upset him so badly, he couldn't even stand the kids. His wife obviously left him and took those kids since he couldn't deal with them. He's all alone now because of the hypersensitivity. This was really heartbreaking since he's such a kind man. So there you have it, the issue of hypersensitivity. It's not one to be laughed at. Now, before we get to our guest, Dr. O. Shanik, I'd like to take a very brief moment for our very own switchboard goddess herself, Rebecca Terrell, to give a sample of her amazing story about her own issues with severe hypersensitivity. Please tell the world your story of sensitivity, Rebecca.
Thank you, Ashok. Hi, everyone. I suffered a life-changing brain injury in September of 2008 when I was attacked in my home. I fell backwards. My skull hit an open oven drawer and then slammed many times against my ceramic-tiled kitchen floor. Initially, when seeking medical care, it wasn't clear that I had a brain injury, but in the days that followed, I had many changes occurring that led me to this diagnosis and rehab. I had extreme sensitivities, especially to light, sound, and touch. I would try to watch TV, but the lights were painful to look at, and the motion made me sick. I couldn't even make out the images or read the words on the screen. And even at the lowest volume possible, it was painful to listen to. Everything in my world seemed so loud and fast, and I felt like I was going in slow motion and the world was a blur. Even to hear the noises outside my house felt painfully loud. My ears felt full, and I had this constant sound as if I were holding a seashell to my ear, like when I was a kid. I had a hard time getting things I wanted to say out of my mouth. My left side felt heavy from my face to my toes. I was very tired all the time. Many times, I wouldn't get much warning before my brain just stopped, and I'd have to sleep. It felt as if I were an electrical appliance someone had just unplugged. Any motion around me or any motions that pulsated my body, such as a car ride, made me very dizzy. It felt as if I were on the teacup ride at Disney World and no one would stop the ride. Things like wind blowing in my hair was painful. Little things like my windshield wipers going on a rainy day would send me spinning and ruin my entire day, even the motion of an elevator ride. I just never knew what would and wouldn't affect me. Aside from the visual issues, I had many other challenges, including vestibular issues, that made me feel like I was an airplane with one propeller out, and also issues with proprioception, as I didn't know where my body was in relation to the rest of the world. I felt like a weeble wobble, only sometimes I would fall down. These are just a few hypersensitivity issues I want to mention tonight. You can read my full detailed story on my Facebook in my notes section and post it in several of the brain injury support groups. You can't miss which Rebecca Terrell I am. I'm the one with blue glasses. Thank you all for listening.
Wow, Rebecca, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your story. You certainly are a survivor and the perfect definition of the word warrior. In fact, that's you, Rebecca, the warrior princess.
Yes, I am a warrior.
All right, so let's now get to our very special guest, who I mentioned before, the chairman of the Brain Injury Association of America Board of Directors, Dr. Gregory Oshanek. Now, are you there, doctor?
I'm still here. Interestingly, Ashok, as you were talking, I had my own kind of sensory experience. All of a sudden, the sound cut out, and I was left with about a two-minute gap in terms of your description of your hypersensitivities, which in many respects is probably similar to kind of the intermittent absences that people in your situations experience, and then trying to figure out from context what I missed. Plus, I don't even have a face to look at to be able to pick up expressions or to read lips.
Wow, that's amazing. Thanks for returning to the show, even with you got your absence and everything. It is an honor to have you on my show, and I think before we get caller questions, I mean, I'd like to start the conversation with, what I think is one of the most important questions of the night. What, doctor, do you consider to be the exact definition of hypersensitivity, whether it be sight, hearing, or smell, or touch, or taste? What's the definition, and why is this a common effect of brain injury?
Hypersensitivity is a failure of the normal dampening mechanisms that all of us develop as we are growing up, as our brains are developing. It is the abnormal state where, for a multitude of reasons, we lose the ability to turn down the volume, turn down the brightness, turn down the intensity of the stimulus that's coming in. One of the things that is fairly common just in individuals if they have not had any kind of concussion is that they will become more sensitive to a sensory experience if they're deprived of input to that sensory experience. Anybody who has had the experience of being in a dark movie theater only to walk outside on a bright afternoon and you immediately are kind of blinded by the intense light are experiencing a form of hypersensitivity, which is transient. So we all have the capacity to experience that even in normal situations. However, in the new normal following a concussion, we find that those mechanisms are much more fragile, much more labile.
I see. And so I'm curious then, out of all the senses, there seems to be two that everyone really seems to have problems with, I think, which is sight and hearing. And I'm wondering, what exactly do you have, what coping methods do you have for sight sensitivity issues?
Well, let me first kind of give a general kind of overlay. Mm-hmm. One of the ways to look at episodes of hypersensitivity is to use them as kind of a thermometer or a barometer of your fatigue level. If one is more fatigued, one will have more difficulty with hypersensitivity issues. It's one of the reasons why customarily toward evening, if there's the light sensitivity, one has more difficulty, especially with the contrast dark to light. So the four foundations, as I think we talked about last time, Ashok, is that, you know, you've got to be getting adequate sleep that's restorative. You have to be staying well hydrated since your brain is 70 to 80% water. You have to be nutritionally stable, not a lot of high concentrated sweets for a quick up and then a quick drop. And you also need to be getting some level of exercise to increase and increase blood flow and increase the metabolism of your brain. So in hypersensitivity situations, one needs to be careful that, you know, that's the first thing, is to kind of go through that little pre-flight checklist, as it were. In terms of vision and visual hypersensitivity, you know, Rebecca, I think you gave some excellent examples in terms of hypersensitivity that relates to changes in visual spatial perception, issues of motion and vestibular or the inner ear balance mechanisms, where we end up finding an increase in nausea, an increase in irritability, an increase in agitation as we're trying to look through or look past the windshield wipers on the car. If again, you think about visual sensitivity as a need to kind of turn down the volume, that kind of gives some indication of the types of things that may be helpful. For example, wearing a brimmed hat, wearing polarized glasses. Some individuals even find that tinted glasses, be they rose-tinted or blue-tinted, may make a difference, or for some individuals, even the yellow or amber kind of tints can make a difference. There is a risk, though, that if we don't push our vision to some degree in terms of having to deal with the hypersensitivity and to have some degree of discomfort periodically, it's the old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it, and it will make it even more sensitive over the period of time following that.
Wow. And okay, so when you were discussing sight, you actually related it a lot to auditory issues, which brings me to ask you to discuss the, like, hearing hypersensitivities. Now, I'd already discussed the tinnitus, and I'd like to know some more issues that are involved with hearing and auditory problems, and what are coping methods you can offer for tinnitus and other issues.
Well, in terms of hearing issues, one of the things that our ears share with our eyes is that we generally employ two of them to be able to localize, either localize visually or localize by sound. Just as you can't tell depth with one eye, you can't tell location with only one ear. If there is an asymmetry in terms of your speed of processing the signal then of what you're hearing, then you'll not only have difficulty with your ability to hear and localize sound, you'll also have difficulty in terms of what's called auditory processing, where there's a slight, it's somewhat the equivalent of hearing double. You'll hear a word okay, there's more overlap with a sentence, there's more overlap with a paragraph, and if somebody's talking at length or in a page type of format, it's going to sound like Charlie Brown Christmas with a wah, wah, wah type of response. The other difficulty that occurs in terms of the auditory issue is that there is a difficulty in what's called auditory figure ground, that is being able to lock on to the source of the noise when you're faced with background noise. So standing in a checkout line trying to talk to the cashier and there's noise behind him or her, having a hard time focusing on what that person's saying, kind of bleeding in, it all tends to have the same kind of quality and you lose the content. In other situations, there can be subtle changes in terms of the response of the ears actually the eardrum in terms of dealing with loud noise, so-called hyperacutism, where with a loud noise, normally what our ears do spontaneously is slacken up the tympanic membrane, the eardrum, much as the sound of a tom-tom is different than the tighter snare drum kind of sound. There can be various types of peripheral nerve, cranial nerve types of issues that can create a problem with the reflex there, such that the louder noises are not dampened automatically, and that contributes to the hypersensitivity to noise.
Mm-hmm. And we should start taking calls, but before that, I just had one last question, and it's actually kind of interesting. To deal with my tinnitus, I actually went to a hypnotherapist who tried to put me under hypnosis. I mean, and it was rather funny. Of course, it didn't work. And then I went to a therapist, a counselor, who tried to discuss the concept of widening my vision so that the hemianopsia could be lessened. And I found all that to be kind of silly. But at the same time, I wanted to find out from you, what do you feel the impact of psychotherapy and psychological-related therapies have on hypersensitivity issues? And do you think that they help?
I think that anything that improves the individual's coping and adaptation and acceptance of the new normal is certainly important. Many times individuals may be unable to give in, as it were, to the sense that things are different and continue trying to do things the same way that they did pre-injury. As you have experienced, one has to figure out ways of compensating and working to take over, to find other substitutions. The idea of psychotherapy, the idea of counseling, the critical element from my perspective there is that it decreases your anxiety. Anytime you have anxiety, you add anxiety to any medical problem or neurologic problem, it compounds and multiplies the severity of it. So by reducing the stress through whether it's hypnosis, whether it's acupuncture, whether it's psychotherapy, whether it's working in other areas in terms of other stresses in your life, in terms of relationships, whatever, those things will have a trickle-down effect in terms of improving the tinnitus. The tinnitus can also have a relationship to the amount of sodium that you're taking in as a nutritional issue. And if individuals are using too many soft drinks and sodas that are high in sodium, if they're salting their foods too much, occasionally adjustments in sodium intake can also make a difference.
Oh, I see. And but I think what you mentioned that was most important is the fact that your state of mind affects pretty much everything, so obviously it would affect the issue of hypersensitivity in your body too. So I guess in this realm, psychotherapy and counseling is, you know, they are pretty effective in terms of changing your mood and dealing with and coping with what's happened to your body. And I think it's time to take calls. And I'd like to say to my listeners, even though you might want to ask the doctor many types of questions because he pretty much knows everything, which is everything about this topic, let's try to stay on the subject matter. So tonight, you know, we only have 1 hour. So tonight, let's stick to the issue of hypersensitivity. And as always, my shows have a large, large amount of callers. So keep your comments brief, all right? Rebecca, who's our first caller?
Yes, we have somebody from the area code 917.
Great. Area code 917, what's your question for the doctor? Are you there, area code 917? Oh, he or she seems to have left. Who's the next caller we have? Rebecca?
We have an area code 520.
Oh, 520. Who's this?
Actually, I'm just listening in, okay?
Oh, okay. So no specific question for the doctor?
No, thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you for listening into the show. Rebecca, do we have another caller?
We have a lot of callers, but nobody with their hand up, if anybody wants to ask a question.
Hi, I'm calling in area code 917 in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay, what's your name?
I'm Richard. I met you at Shulk about 2 weeks ago out in a support group on Seafarers in Union
Correct.
Square.
Yes.
Well, thank you for inviting me to listen in. And,
thank you for showing up. We're happy to have you.
Thanks. I didn't know we had an MD on the air. I suffer with hypersensitivity to noise, primarily more than any other visual stimuli. In the beginning, the first year, it really affected my balance. Anytime I would listen to thumping noise, sudden deep noise, I would fall back. Over the year now, the noise doesn't affect my balance so much, but it does stop my walking limited throughout the day. However, even in the car, I'd have to raise the windows up to avoid any other noise other than being in the car. Mm-hmm. So it causes many distractions and right-sided distortions, and the physical pain associated with that affects my temporal lobe, and I don't know how to deal with that other than close my eyes and breathe. I do see a psychoanalyst and a neuropsychologist, but as far as that goes, sometimes you have to just live with it by carrying the injury with you instead of being someone else. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Richard, I think you raise a good point in terms of how that limits, how noise sensitivity will limit your ability to be out, especially in a more noisy urban area. Some of the things that some of my patients have used with success, you know, instead of using, you know, two earplugs, using only one earplug in one ear, sometimes they've also found that using noise-canceling headphones, especially if they're driving or somebody else is driving, to minimize the amount of fatigue they're experiencing by trying to suppress the sensitivity to the noise as they're driving can make a difference as well. One of the things that oftentimes people feel a little hesitant about is feeling conspicuous by having, you know, a Dayglow orange or yellow earplug in. One of the strategies that some folks find helpful is using earbuds, as you would on your MP3 player or iPod or whatever, and using those because they will dampen out some of the external noise without making it look too conspicuous in terms of public.
Earbuds as in regular earpieces
can sometimes the ones that are a little bit more molded to the ear that kind of fit into the curve, the fold of the ear can be a little better in terms of occluding and decreasing some of the sensitivity.
Right, and actually I'm doing it right now while talking to you. I have the left earpiece in my left ear and have the phone away from me. I was alternating from right to left, but I noticed the increase of the sensitivity more on the right side. And so now I put it back on the left. And with the right side, I lowered the volume by 3 notches. On the left side, I keep it the same. But I noticed I can't use it in both. I have a stimulation that would make the pain increase. So.
Sure. Well, part of the difficulty
is
that brain injuries tend to be asymmetrical. And so if your front end's out of alignment, whether it's vision or hearing or vestibular in terms of balance, it's those kinds of asymmetries that the brain has the most difficulty in terms of trying to compensate for. It's not uncommon that an earplug will work better in one ear, or occluding one ear will work better than occluding the other one. And it's to some degree, it's trial and error on your part, and it may even change from day to day or week to week.
Doctor, I had a question. In terms of pitches, whether it's high pitch or low pitches, does it matter in terms of how you would cope with it or what accessories or whatever you would use to battle it? Because what I'm learning is I do have problems with both pitches, with high and low, and I was wondering, is there a difference in dealing with either one?
In terms of sensitivity or in terms of the tinnitus? Or both?
In terms of sensitivity, actually.
Sensitivity,
not related
yeah.
to tinnitus.
Yeah, it's again, high pitches tend to be more difficult. If you think about, you know, sirens. Sirens are put at a high pitch because that creates an alerting response in the brain much more readily than a lower pitched kind of hum. So it's more of a an orienting kind of sound. So with higher pitches, you're again, well, how high the pitch has to be. Is has been altered by virtue of losing the dampening effect in terms of the ear. Lower pitches tend to be easier. Some people, again, have found that by noise-canceling headphones and kind of some of them are somewhat programmable in terms of higher pitch, lower pitch, depending on the environment you're in. There are also various types of hearing aids or maskers that can be used. That work more for a higher pitch or lower pitch that audiologists can assist with.
Great. And, Richard, I wanted to thank you for the call and the question. It was really, really valuable to hear about this.
I just have one
really
more
great.
Question for the doctor.
Sure.
Before I get off here. Question to you, doctor. Do you know of any compensation for visual lenses? Tends to compensate for vestibular dysfunction, such as losing balance in large crowds?
Well, the typical difficulty for losing balance in large crowds is that folks with vestibular troubles are more reliant on locking onto a target visually. They're using position sense in their legs and trunk, and then they're locking on visually, and then somebody walks in front of where they're keeping their vision locked, and boom, immediately you're kind of crumbling, losing your balance. You know, certainly the use of a walking stick, not a cane, not a crutch that you're leaning on, but just another point of contact, or using like a shopping cart type of thing in stores and malls. One of the strategies that a patient of mine employed that worked in a hospital was to actually walk along the edge of the hallway and kind of run the finger across along the wall as another point of contact. And whenever coming to an intersection, of hallways, stopping, locking visually onto the far wall, and then going there directly, putting their hand on that wall, their finger on that wall, and then continuing in that manner. If you're walking down a public street, that's a little more difficult to do, and sometimes just the walking stick type of approach may work better.
Great.
So not a cane, a walking stick?
Well, a hiking stick, or I've used The word cane is not to suggest that you need it to kind of support yourself on as you're walking, but it just gives you another point of contact, just like an outrigger on a canoe.
Okay.
That makes sense. And now, Rebecca? Oh. Rebecca, do we have another caller?
Yes, we do. We have caller from area code 803.
All right. 803, who's this?
Les Paul Morgan.
Oh, okay. What's your question for the doctor?
Hi. Well, today's show couldn't be more about me. When I turned on my computer and saw it was time for your show to start, my ears were buzzing so loud from the tinnitus that I could hardly think when I first called you. I'm a traumatic brain injury and 2 brain aneurysm survivor. When I heard your story.
Okay.
You and I are about 80% of the same thing when I listen to it. I've had an intravenous malformation, and I'll sometimes have a really deep hum start, and then suddenly it's almost like I lose my hearing for a few seconds, and then a really high-pitched ringing will start. And, it's so loud sometimes I was like, gosh, what am I going to do? And right now I'd say it's medium high right now. I mean, it's almost as loud as when you speak right now. And I just wonder...
Wow. Well, we really are mirror images, what with the tinnitus and the AVM. It's
yeah, when I heard your story,
great
I had
that you called.
I had goosebumps all over when I was listening to your story. So, first of all, it's very cool to be talking to another AVM survivor.
That's true, absolutely. It's great to meet another AVM survivor, absolutely. So, doctor, do you have any other, you know, ideas of how to cope with this sort of tinnitus?
Well, one of the things to be careful of, and Ashok, you talked about this earlier, is, you know, does the sensory abnormality relate to an aura? Is it something that is indicative of some sort of irritability in the brain that's either leading into a seizure or leading into some sort of mild short-circuiting? In general, what if you are finding that that there are other associated symptoms, fatigue, loss of muscle tone, things of that nature that accompany that type of a sensory experience, it would be worthwhile to discuss that more with your physician and maybe even have a sleep-deprived EEG to take a look at that.
I see.
In terms of frequency, though, of the tinnitus, If you remember physics class from high school, if you've got a certain sound, it's got a certain frequency, a certain waveform, there is the ability to identify that waveform through certain audiologic tests that then, if you give the mirror image, it actually cancels out that noise for certain individuals. And it's a little machine or a little... a device that looks like a behind-the-ear hearing aid, again, called a tinnitus masker. That can be something that can be of use in a situation where the tone of the tinnitus is fairly constant. If the tone
What's the length of time that you have to use that?
It would be something that you would use kind of on an ongoing basis, kind of a permanent thing. It is a device that I've had patients using probably now for a good 12, 14 years that will use it. It's a more sophisticated version, if you will, of the white noise, a more specific version of what you were discussing with the radio station that signed off.
Right. Okay. Great. Rebecca, who's our next caller?
All right. We have a caller from 410 area code.
All right, 410, who is this?
Hi, Ashok, it's Scott.
Oh, hey, Scott, what's your question? How are you doing?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing great. This is Dr. Oshanik, pretty amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, great. I know. It's like he's hitting all these points, and I'm scribbling on this paper because I just kind of want to ask questions related to what he's talking about. But
he really is. He's the best, yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I feel like a poster boy for hyperacusis, kind of. I'm really pretty sound sensitive, and for example, movies are just. I always have to wear earplugs to movies just because I find the sound deafening. Always, especially in the new theaters, in the new Dolby systems and such. It's difficult to get through a 2-hour movie. But what I wanted to ask, what particularly fascinated me about something the doctor said, is he talked about hearing a voice like the teacher from Charlie Brown. I had that experience. Yeah, I know. And I was like, what? Because I've had that experience about probably 2 months ago, and I was speaking with someone, and they were trying to get information from me, and they asked me, so what's your name, what's your address? And I was hearing the words, but it was just as though it were Charlie Brown's teacher. My brain was not receiving. So it appears that, and I used to teach special education, so I had kind of a background in brain, and we dealt with learning disabled kids who had various difficulties with language and with expression, and it was termed aphasia. And purely it was just they were having aphasic experiences. And my question was, is that in essence what we're experiencing, kind of a brain just the brain isn't processing and receiving the information and converting it appropriately for our brains to understand what's being said.
Yeah, Scott, that can be one explanation. You know, if, however, you find that by occluding one ear, sticking your finger in one ear, you're able to understand better what the individual is saying and you're not getting that kind of wah-wah kind of input, then it's probably more related to the overlapping of the sounds kind of hearing double as opposed to seeing double. The idea of coming up with an aphasia periodically for understanding would be pretty unusual unless somebody was having some sort of like an irritability or seizure type of region in that area that periodically would kind of shut that down. That would be one of the more significant things to be worried about. But again, if you stick your finger in one ear and you can hear better, or you occlude one ear, or you can cup one ear and you hear better, that's probably more related to the auditory processing or the inequality in the speed of the left eighth cranial nerve and the right eighth cranial nerve.
All right. Got that, Scott?
You know, Ashok, there's one other thing that I did want to mention. There is an experimental treatment that is being looked at for tinnitus. A number of centers across the country are doing studies as we speak, using a technology called transcranial magnetic stimulation. TMS is a device where you have a very powerful electromagnet that focuses the magnetic field over a certain part of the brain as you direct the magnet toward there. And there's some pretty interesting studies that individuals who have chronic tinnitus with treatment with transcranial magnetic stimulation get enduring improvement out to 12 months, at least the most recent studies that I've seen. If folks are interested in that, if they go to the NIH website, NIH.gov, and under the clinical trials section, type in transcranial magnetic stimulation or even just tinnitus, and it should pop up a list of facilities that are currently recruiting for subjects.
Oh, okay. And, Dr., on a related note, how is that actually caused in terms of, auditory tinnitus? How is that caused with brain injury? Are there different forms?
There's kind of two basic concepts. One is that it can be from a more peripheral kind of issue with the actual inner ear. If you think about the hearing apparatus in the inner ear, thinking like a sounding board or a harp, it's one wire that's vibrating uncontrollably, and so that's why you've got a single frequency in that situation. From a central standpoint, it appears that there is a relationship. There's a concept called denervation supersensitivity, which means that if you take away the stimulation to a certain region of the body or of the brain, that there is an extra attempt by increasing its sensitivity of that area to get some sort of meaningful stimulation. So it's almost as if the brain is trying to put out more centers to be able to hear and perceive, and so you're getting kind of a feedback or a feed-forward kind of episode with a central type of tinnitus.
Okay, got it. Let's see. Rebecca, can you pick up, actually, I'm looking, can you pick up the 347 call?
347.
Did you
see
it?
Yes, I can. I see it now. 347, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Is this Frank?
This is Frank from Brooklyn.
Great.
And
my New York brother.
Question.
Go ahead.
Huh?
Go ahead, my New York brother.
Oh, okay. I have a question. First of all, let me say that I'm not a brain injury victim, but I do have a family member who has suffered a brain injury, and I'm just trying to listen to get a little more understanding of what's going on, but I notice when I'm visiting my nephew that I can start walking across the room, and he'll start holding his ears and screaming, it hurts, and crying, and if I go back over to, like, the sofa or whatever and try to console him or whatever, he's still screaming and saying it hurts. I guess I'm just trying to figure out what's going on or what's causing that.
How old is your nephew?
He's 10.
10, okay.
And he had a hemorrhage a few years ago, so.
Yeah. One of the difficulties is that, you know, in as our brains mature, they're integrating all sorts of sensory information. You know, your vision, your motor tracking so that you can watch the baseball as you're swinging the bat to hit it, your hearing so that, you know, when you're out at PE and the PE teacher blows the whistle, you know how to, you know, respond in terms of that. So there's a lot of interaction between visual and motor and balance and auditory. Part of what's difficult with children is that that system is not developed fully, and so you have much more random kind of interaction. Much more difficult for them to find something that will dampen it down. Occasionally, looking at other types of stimulation at that time, you know, whether it's kind of gentle massage, whether it's for some kids it's rocking themselves, may in fact make a difference temporarily in terms of some of the stimulation or some of the overstimulation. Occasionally having, you know, a little tighter fitting clothes, almost like a swaddling kind of situation, sometimes can make a difference too. But it's more related to just the fact that it's their brains are not quite so well developed to be able to contain a certain type of hypersensitivity.
Okay. Wow, you got that, Frank?
Yes, thank you very much.
Great. Wow, I'm just looking at these calls, and I'm the reason, Rebecca, I wanted him is because there are a lot of listeners whose loved ones have brain injury, and they themselves do not, and they have to deal with, you know, their loved ones having these sensitivity issues and how they would deal with them. And I think we needed, you know, to hear from that perspective. And once again, I do believe, I'm trying to think, go ahead. Who's next?
All right, we have a caller from the area code 330.
All right, 330, go for it.
Hi, my name is Scarlett, and I have a question about, you're talking about the ears and the sight and all of that, but what about speech? My question's for Dr. Olshanek. My speech changes with just randomly, actually. It's off right now, but then it will go to normal, and then it can go down to like a 12-year-old girl. What would be that cause from?
The changes in speech and intonation can reflect either a change in the right side of the brain in a right-handed person that is responsible for melody or intonation or inflection, so that it almost can sound at times like a foreign language that the individual has or an accent they have from a foreign language. It does go back to relating to some of the processing issues we were talking earlier in terms of auditory. On occasion, it can also relate to a fatigue component that as the voice becomes weaker, you may see a change in pitch or a pitchiness to it. Think about kind of, you know, voice cracking when you're particularly tired or if you've got a cold or something of that nature. So it generally relates, the pitch changes generally do come back to a fatigue issue typically, or there's other types of language issues, either being able to come up with words. Some people, if they're bilingual, we'll find that one language there will work better than the other. That's because as we're older and we learn a language, instead of it kind of being in the left hemisphere of our brain, it's more represented in the right hemisphere. So sometimes there are some other strategies that speech pathologists can work on with the individual to help them compensate and develop other methods.
Wow, Scarlett, thank you so much for this, because this was the one issue that wasn't addressed tonight, which was speech. And I think this was really valuable for all of us, because I actually had something to ask Dr. Oshanik as well. When I was recovering early on from the AVM and the brain hemorrhage, I spoke British English. And it was very odd for me to get back into, I mean, it wasn't an accent, it was just the way I spoke. And I'm thinking it was because my nurse was actually British, but I also wondered, was there any reason, what would you think your reasoning is, the reasoning for that is? And it took me a while from speech therapist to learn to speak American English, actually. So it wasn't a language issue, it was actually an accent issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, the clipped kind of speech could be a reflection of, early memory tracings or early tonal tracings, what's called the phonemic inventory. That's why children that learn languages before age four generally will speak those languages without any type of accent. So it may, Ashok, it may relate to individuals that you were around at a very early age in your life who spoke a more British type of English or clipped English. And as those pathways were coming back on board, those were the first areas that were kind of reconnecting.
So it had nothing to do with the fact that the nurse was British. It had to do with years before that I had been.
It certainly could also be related to some degree to the nurse being British. I mean, a lot of people have had the experience of living in Australia, coming back, and all of a sudden they've got colloquialisms and various speech patterns that are clearly non-American just from the familiarity or just from being immersed in that type of situation. So potentially the nurse may have had some role to play as well, but I'd be a little suspicious that there was some sort of a memory tracing there somewhere, Ashok, that kind of resonated with that.
Wow, that's really, really fascinating, because I always assumed it was because of the whole echoing syndrome that babies do, to their parents. And since I'd become a baby again, I thought that I was speaking because that was the way the nurse spoke. I had no idea it could have been related to, who I was associated with when I was younger, who I was exposed to. This is, really great news for me. I had no clue. Wow. And, okay, let's, Rebecca, who's next?
I don't see anybody with a question mark up. I can...
Well, let's hear some comments.
All right. I'm going to open the mics up.
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
This is Scarlett again. I didn't get to finish asking questions because you jumped in and started talking about your issues to Dr.
Oshanik
on the voice. So it's more like a fatigue thing that is basically what you're saying, Dr. Oshanik. But sometimes it is also just for no reason. I don't know if lights could trigger that also, my voice will be like a 12-year-old Southern girl at times, and it even has been down to like a 4-year-old girl. But I do have an appointment with you next week, so I guess I can discuss more then when I see you in person.
Okay, that's excellent. We can look at it. One of the things when I use the word fatigue, I think it's important to not just think about the normal things like maybe not sleeping as well the night before, etc. I mean, fatigue will come about if you're in a noisy environment and you're having to marshal your resources to suppress the noise, to be able to ignore and distract yourself. Or if you're in pain and you've got to kind of suppress the pain or distract yourself from the pain. Or if you've had the flu or a cold or something of that nature. The fatigue has to do with not having as much reserve, much energy reserves, And when anything novel comes up of that nature or anything unexpected or unanticipated, when you run out of gas, it sounds like for you running out of gas is when your speech is declines in terms of that. But interesting information, interesting for us to explore next week.
Thank you, Scarlett. Rebecca, who's our next? And it's not about, we don't have questions, it could be comments as well.
Hello? Anybody have a comment? I've opened up the line. Hello?
Hi,
what area code is this? Hello? Hi, my name is Lindsay.
All right, what's your, do you have a question for the doctor?
Yes, I do. Doctor, I have a question because I'm worried about my headaches that I was having a couple years back, and I ended up with the doctors think I had pressure on my brain to cause me, when I had migraines, not to see or feel. My voice would slur, and they never were able to tell me why I had pressure on my brain from migraines.
That's kind of a can be a complicated, well, not could be, it, I mean, it is a complicated situation. You know, migraines are kind of seen as having some characteristics of blood vessel kind of changes, somewhat of a constriction. They're also seen as having some relationship to areas of irritability in the brain, almost, you know, kind of a seizure-like type of quality because of either the blood vessel change or other types of issues. Depending on where those are occurring, that will then trigger or determine what your constellation of symptoms is, whether it's the pressure, whether it's a visual issue or a distortion in one of the quadrants of your vision, or even if there's almost like a rapid sequence, kind of like, you know, taking rapid photos of a sporting event, can also be an issue or a type of visual phenomenon with migraine. You know, certainly various, one of the big culprits that oftentimes doesn't get looked at is people who are using a lot of vitamin supplements. And vitamin A in particular, if one is taking too much of that, can result in some brain swelling, as it were, and because that's one of the four vitamins. A, D, E, and K are the ones that get stored in our fat cells in our body and aren't just washed out like all of the other B vitamins are, et cetera, or vitamin C, et cetera, would be. So it's a little more complicated, Lindsay, than being able to give a 25-word or less answer. I'm really sorry, but you know, it sounds like you know, needs to have a pretty thorough workup and maybe even some studies of other sorts, you know, EEGs or other types of studies.
All right. Doctor, you have time. Well, actually, we have time for one last call. Can you pick the next area code up, Rebecca?
949?
Jack, good evening. Randy from Southern California. I've been listening to the show, and Doctor, you said so many things that really hit home with me. One in particular, early on, you said, you know, we're talking about use it or lose it. When you talk about auditory, you talked about visual. The question I had was, as I recovered from my injury, I used a lot of, I did a lot of things, but a couple of computer programs that I found very, very helpful that basically worked on peripheral vision, your hearing. Without getting into much detail, what are your thoughts about some of the training programs that are available?
I think as an adjunct.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but actually the show is going to end in about 30 seconds. So, Doctor, any last words to give him and to all listeners?
The last words are that using things like computer-assisted programs and games can be helpful, but it's not a substitute for medical care or care from a rehabilitation therapist.
A rehabilitation therapist is the person most necessary for any issue for hypersensitivity. Is that correct?
I would think speech and occupational therapy, audiology, physical therapy would be the areas. Yes, sir.
All right, then. Well, thank you, Dr. Oshanek, and thank you for my listeners. And you've made this a really, really wonderful show. And it is a topic that we should all be dealing with, because hypersensitivity affects every single one of us. There is not one brain injury survivor who is not somehow affected with sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch. And all I can say is Dr. Oshanek really, really explained everything really well for all the questions that we had. And I hope, Dr. Oshanek, you will return for another show.
I would be honored to do so. Thanks again, Ashok.
Thank you very much. And once again, thank you, everyone. I will be back next month, the second Monday of each month, all right? So I do hope that I can hear from you, and I do wish you all the best in your recovery and in everything else you all have to do with your sight, speech, hearing, taste, and smell. It's a tough road, but I have a feeling that we're all going to make it. We're all going to survive. Survived this far, I'm sure that we can survive some more. Not only that, I think we'll triumph for everything that we're going through. And thank you.